Okay, my name is Rick Bradley, and this tape will be for the Society for American Baseball Research Oral History Committee. And today is November 21st, 1994, and I'm in Euclid, Ohio, and today we're talking to Bob Kane. Bob, you had the nickname Sugar, which obviously is obvious, Sugar Kane, but who gave that to you?
Well, that I really don't remember who gave it to me, but during my career in baseball, I've been called a lot of names, but it seemed like with my last name being Kane, why somebody started out at some sports writer or something, started out saying Sugar, and it just stuck with me.
Is that the only nickname you had when you were playing?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell me about growing up in Longford, Kansas. That's where you were born. Is that where you also grew up?
I was born in Longford, Kansas, and then shortly afterwards moved to Salina, which is about 20, 25 miles away from there. And I grew up there, went through high school in Salina, and started out playing midget league ball, played for the years that I could in that, and then I went into American Legion in Salina. And from Salina, I went down to Coffeyville, Kansas, and started playing Van Johnson baseball. And from then on, I had my offers to go into professional baseball, and I went right in right after I graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm. What did your dad do?
He was had a string of taxi cabs back in Salina and was in that business for several years.
What did your family think about you making baseball as a career?
Well, I had three brothers and two sisters, and I was the only one. Matter of fact, my younger brother, Don, who was 2 years younger than I, he was my catcher in midget league ball for about 4 years there, and we were one of the better batteries in baseball, and we thought that he was going to keep on with baseball, but consequently he went into the service and hurt his back, so that got him out of baseball. But we were a pretty good battery back then.
How'd you get, do you remember how you became interested in baseball when you were small?
I really don't know. I do know that I picked it up as soon as I could be able to throw a baseball. And then in school, every lunch hour or whenever I possibly could, I was out in the playground playing ball with somebody.
What positions did you play when you were growing up?
Well, I started out playing first base. I played the outfield and pitching.
I guess it's being left-handed.
I didn't care what I was playing, just so as long as I was in the game playing someplace.
When you were growing up, did you have a favorite ball player?
Not particularly, because truthfully, I had never seen a major league ballpark until I actually got into the major leagues myself. That was one thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to get to the major leagues. And I always had said that I'll never go to one of them until I can actually play in mm-hmm. one of them.
You didn't follow any particular team then, or St. Louis? Or?
No, I wasn't following any particular team because we had a Van Johnson team in Salina there, and they were playing in the old Western League there. And I was just watching them playing all the time.
Tell me how the circumstances around how you were finally signed to a professional contract.
Well, I was playing American Legion ball. And we ended up going to the state tournament, and I had offers from 8 major league ball clubs. Back then, there was only 16 major league clubs. And I did have offers from 8 major league ball clubs, but back then, I guess one of my favorite players would be Carl Hubbell, the left-handed pitcher for the old Giants. Mm-hmm. And I kind of followed them a little bit, and that's why I went ahead and signed the contract with the Giant organization.
And then you started off, tell me about 1942, the Beverly Longhorns. Is that semi-pro?
That was a semi-pro team there in Salina, and we played some of the better teams throughout the state of Kansas. And with the makeup of the players that we had from our American Legion club, we ended up with a pretty good ball club then.
Was there anybody that you either played with or against semi-pro that eventually made it to the big leagues? Or
there isn't any that I can remember, no.
All right, then let's take it. Let's just talk about your minor league career from, let's go from 43 then through 49, starting with Bristol.
Well, when I signed with the Giant organization, they signed me to Bristol, Virginia, Tennessee, which was in the Appalachian League, Class D ball. And I started out there. I pitched, if I could remember right, I pitched the first game, second game I was playing first base, and the third game I was playing in the outfield, and then the fourth game I was pitching again. So I was playing pretty near every day, and I really enjoyed it down there. But I only played part of a year because I was drafted into the service at that time, a little after the middle of the year.
Mm-hmm. What branch of the service were you in?
I was in the Navy, in the Coast Guard.
And where did you wind up in the service?
I ended up out in San Pedro, California.
Any run into any other ballplayers while you're out there?
No, but I just missed being able to stay at up in Chicago there with when I first went into boot camp, when Bob Feller and all of them were up there. They told me that if I would have brought forth all the information about playing baseball beforehand, they possibly could have kept me there.
Mm-hmm. There was were there any, I don't know if the word is shenanigans, but what was going on there during World War II where they had, I don't know if it was generals, I'm not exactly sure how to describe this, but people were holding certain ballplayers, keeping them, just so they could form their own teams, and then some sort of ego trip, my team can beat your team?
Yes, there was a deal up in Great Lakes there that they had a very, very good ball club. Matter of fact, they had a lot of ex-major league ball club players that were in the service, and they kept them right there and strictly for baseball. And that was what I was hoping I could have ended up doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, war's over, and then you're back to minor leagues again, and you're in Manchester in 46?
Yes. After I got out of the service, I went up to Manchester, New Hampshire, and that was in the New England League. And that was a league where we had a pretty stiff competition there, especially with Nashua, New Hampshire. And on that club, they had Walt Alston as a player manager playing first base. And they had a few good other players too, namely Don Newcomb was one of the pitchers, and Roy Campanella was a catcher.
Mm-hmm.
And I can always remember that in Nashua, every home run that Roy Campanella hit, someone there gave him 100 baby chicks, and he hit enough home runs that year to start a chicken farm.
100 baby chicks, that's interesting. Were you still property of the Giants?
I was still the property of the Giants, because back then, when you signed with a club, you were theirs until they wanted to get rid of you.
Until death do us part. Let me ask you this. What was the 46, 45, 46, 47 was when the color barrier was broken in baseball. What were your, what do you remember about 46 playing against Newcomb and
I didn't feel any animosity there because they were ball players. We all loved the game of baseball, and we were in it for one thing, and that is to do good, give the fans something to cheer for.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't recall any instance that any trouble that we ever had up there. And then I played against Jackie Robinson the following year down when I went to Jersey City. He was with Newark. And one of the games, as soon as he gets on first base, he turns around, steals second, steals third. Before we knew it, there was another star right there that was in the making.
Mm-hmm. 47, Jersey City, this is still the Giants.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then 48?
48, between Jersey City and then Minneapolis, and which was still the American Association AAA team for the Giants.
Minneapolis Millers?
Minneapolis Millers, right. And
did they play at, was it Nicollet Park?
Nicollet Park, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that is one place where I did hit a home run. You mentioned before I never hit a home run.
Well, I was just talking about in the big leagues.
But we played there. I was there for part of the year, and then course of the year they traded me to Memphis.
Okay.
Which was a Chicago White Sox affiliate. And I went down to Memphis, and in 49. And I had a fair year with Memphis, with the Memphis Chicks, and they turned around. The Chicago White Sox brought me up at the end of the 49 season.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the record book says September the 18th of 49 was your first day in the big leagues. What do you remember about your first day?
I can remember the first game I was in. And we were playing in Boston, and we were getting beat pretty badly, and they bring me in to relief pitch, and who was the first hitter that I faced was Ted Williams. Well, I ended up with a 3-2 count on him, and at that time I had a pretty good curveball, and we called for a curveball, and I threw a curveball, and Ted Williams backed away a little bit and took it for a called third strike, and that was the first batter that I ever faced in the major leagues, but I can truthfully say that was probably the last time I ever struck him out.
What were you thinking right after your first batter, you just struck out Ted Williams, certainly no small feat. What were you
thinking? I thought if I could strike him out, I could get anybody in the major leagues out.
Mm-hmm. What kind of team, I know you're just up for a couple weeks at the end of the year, but the White Sox didn't have a very good team in 49. I was going through the record books, and I think, is it Steve Suchok, is that his name?
Yes,
that was one. He led the team with 7 home runs.
Right. And we had a bunch of pitchers that were fair pitchers that we just didn't have the hitting that year to win any ball games. And then when we went to spring training the next year, which was really a bad year because, for me, for the simple reason that Chicago was loaded with left-handed pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And they had just signed a bonus pitcher. I think they gave him $50,000 bonus signing, Jack Bruner. And at that time, that was a big amount of money to be giving a ball player. And I was about whether it was 5th, 6th, or 7th in line in regards to being left-handers on the ball club. But I had a real good spring training and ended up making the ball club that year.
Not too far into the 1950 season, in fact, I think it was your first major league start against the Yankees.
That was in Yankee Stadium. That was a game that I can remember very clearly, too, that every ball that I hit or that I pitched was hit hard, seemed to be hit right at somebody, and we ended up beating the Yankees 15-0 in their home park, which is to this day, I think, the worst beating they've ever had in their home park.
Yeah, I looked it up. It said it ties the worst shutout defeat ever for the Yankees.
Well, that's something good.
So you start at your first batter, you strike out Williams, your first start, you beat the world champion Yankees, 15-0, and you've got to be thinking, wow, this is...
Well, I ended up that year having good luck against the Yankees because I beat them 4 times that year.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the...
They won 9 games.
I only won 9 games all year.
So
half of them were there.
So you were the first Yankee killer before. Was it Frank Larry that they used to call the Yankee killer after
mm-hmm.
you? Now, 9 days later, we talked a little bit about this upstairs. A guy who seemed to become intertwined with your career, a guy by the name of Bob Feller, did something to you in the big leagues that hadn't been done up to that point.
Well, now, Bob Feller, that was the following year, though, in 1951.
Well, I was talking about the home run that he hit.
Oh, that's one home run I'll always remember. Feller, I threw a fastball, seemed to be about around knee high, and it must have been out over the plate because he teed off on that ball and hit it like a golf ball, straight out over the center field fence. And that would be one that I can always remember. I know there was a lot of others, but that's one I do remember.
It was about 2 weeks later, White Sox fired the manager, Jack Onslow. Is that how we pronounce his name?
Happy Jack Onslow, yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And what did you think of him? What kind of manager?
I liked him. He was a very easygoing manager, and he fought for his players.
Mm-hmm.
But I got along with him very well.
You know, I think the Sox were only 8-22 when he was let go, so
yes.
not a surprise. But then they brought in Red Corrigan.
Corrigan, yes.
And he finished out the year. What did you think of him?
And I thought he was a very good manager. He seemed to go a little more for the basic baseball than before, but we all liked him. We all got along very well.
And the White Sox, about the same kind of year they had in 49, a couple games worse, but sixth place again, and 38 games behind the Yankees.
Right.
Another long year. I just want to talk about 51 just for the little while that you were with the White Sox and right up until the time that you were traded to the Tigers. When you were traded to Detroit, now you had already been traded once from the Giant organization to the White Sox organization.
Right.
When you went from the White Sox to Detroit, what did you think of the trade?
Well, I liked the trade. At first, I didn't particularly care for it for the simple reason that I thought I'd made my name pretty good with the White Sox, and they were in the process of building at that particular time. But I was very happy getting over Detroit, and I ended up liking pitching in Detroit. And matter of fact, to me, I think even to this day, they've got the best baseball fans there is in the country.
Mm-hmm. Why do you say that? Knowledgeable?
They all seem to be very knowledgeable, and they seem very loyal over there. Mm-hmm. They always, maybe it was just the ballpark, the way it's located, the situation of the stands and everything, that they're close to the players, and it was just nice pitching there.
Even though it had to be tough pitching there.
It was rough pitching there with the short left or right field fence, but still, I seem to have a lot of luck with them.
We'll stop on the chronology for a little while. I hope they know that you batted left and you threw left. Go ahead and tell me what kind of pitches that you threw. What kind of a repertoire did you have?
I didn't have anything fancy. All I threw was the fastball, curveball, and changeup at that particular time. And I can always remember the saying of what Ted Williams says, that hitting is a matter of timing, and pitching goes along the same line, that if you can get the hitter a little bit off balance a little bit, keep him guessing, never give him the two pitches the same, why, you've got a pretty good chance with him.
Were you a hard thrower? Or?
I didn't consider myself as a hard thrower. I thought I had, mixed up with my curveball, I always had a pretty good curveball.
Mm-hmm. I know you talked a little bit about Carl Hubbell. Did you ever mess around with the screwball or anything like him?
I tried it later on after I got calcium on my wrist, but it never did work for me.
What kind of hitter would you describe yourself as? You didn't have any home runs in the big leagues, but you hit about 200 for...
I hit awful close to 260 in 1951 while I was with Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed hitting. Matter of fact, even when I went down to St. Louis, I was used a time or two as a pinch hitter.
In your pitching motion, was there anybody that you copied, or was it all... Can you think back? Was there anybody that you saw that you thought, well, maybe I'll try that? Or?
Nobody in particular, other than when I was with the White Sox, they had a pitcher, left-handed pitcher. Well, they had two of them, Billy Pierce and Bill White. And at that particular time, we could have that pretty good move to first base, and I would watch Bill White very closely because he had one of the better pickoffs to first base. And I kind of picked that up, and it helped me along the line.
Mm-hmm. How about what kind of a fielder and a base runner would you consider yourself?
I would say just medium.
Average, huh? All right, let's go back to just a little time that you spent in Detroit, that three quarters of the season or however long it was. Red Rolfe was the manager.
Red Rolfe was the manager,
and,
yes.
And the Tigers wound up fifth place that year, 25 games back. Of course, you weren't with the Tigers in 50, but you certainly faced them. In the year previous, the Tigers had just missed beating out the Yankees by three games. They finished three games back, and now this year you go over to Detroit and they wound up 25 games back. What would you...
Well, it was another case of not getting the hitting when it was really counted. Why, we just couldn't come up with a base hit. And I had a lot of good games with... Detroit that year that it could have gone either way with a few extra base hits that we missed out on.
July the 1st of 51, Bob Feller and you get together again, and He beat you with a no-hitter.
That's right. That was Bob Feller's third no-hitter, and that was out here at Cleveland Stadium. And I can remember that game because of the last pitch of the ball game. Feller throws a pitch that was high and outside, and the umpire called it a strike three on Vic Wirtz. And we all questioned that call, but it was Feller's third no-hitter. And I give up, if I remember right, about five hits in that ball game, and we got beat 2-1, which all the runs were unearned, and with little luck on my part, I could have beat him 1-0 or something, and still lose get the no-hitter out of him.
Hmm. Now, for better or for worse, I think the incident that you're most known for, or certainly one of the incidents you're most known for, was Vec's stunt in August of 51. So let's hear about that.
Well, that was back in August 19th of 51. We were playing a doubleheader down in St. Louis. And Bill Vec had promised the Falstaff Brewery that he was going to put on something very special that day. He had Max Patkin and a whole group of clowns and whatnot to perform between the doubleheader. And he still had this other little surprise. Well, none of us knew anything about it. And during the between games, they roll out a big four-wheeler with a big paper machete cake on it, and they roll it up by home plate, and out jumps a little midget. Well, we didn't pay any attention to it, and none of us knew a thing about it. And the midget gets out of the cake and waves to the fans in the stands and goes over and sits on the St. Louis Browns bench. And none of us knew anything about it, didn't pay any attention to it. We go ahead and get ready to play, and when they announce the lineup, they put Frank Sauchet in the outfield. Well, we knew Frank couldn't throw because of the severe injury he had to his arm. Mm-hmm. We thought something was kind of fishy. But they turned around, they get us out the top of the inning. And then when we go out to the infield and start getting ready to play the second half of the inning, why, they announced the leadoff batter. They announced Eddie Goodell, number 18, batting for Frank Sauchet. Well, the fans really, they tore up the place at that particular time. And Eddie comes out with waving his little miniature bats and everything. In the meantime, before that, Bill Vec had said that he had been teaching him to stand like Joe DiMaggio with his feet spread far apart and teaching him how to crouch over to make a lower target. Well, the boy was only 3'7" to begin with. And when he come up to the plate, well, Ed Hurley, the umpire, you could see that he was very angry at the whole situation, thinking that Bill Vec was making a joke out of the game. And he goes over, starts over towards the Browns dugout, and Zach Taylor, the manager of the Browns, comes out and hands him the contract. Well, Bill, the kind of a man that he was, he knew that he didn't send the contract into the league office till the night before, knowing that it wouldn't get there in time, that the commissioner could do anything about it. So he was in the safe part there. So after Ed Hurley read the contract, he just turned around and says, play ball. Well, he comes back to the home plate, and in the meantime, Bob Swift come out and talked to me and started laughing a little bit, and Bob said it was for real. And when he goes back behind home plate, he lays down on the ground and puts one hand on his head and then holds his glove up there, and Ed Hurley didn't like that and made him get up on his haunches there, to up on his knees there, to give me a lower target. Well, I threw four pitches that were around his head, a little bit above his head, which I think would have been a strike on an ordinary man.
Excuse me.
And after I walked him, he trots down to first base, and he waits for Jim Delsing to come down and pinch run for him. And soon as Delsing got on the first base, he pats him on the rear end and said something to him, and then he trotted back across the infield, which he had to go across the infield to get to the third base side dugout. And he was waving his hat, and the fans really appreciated it. And consequently, I turned around and walked another batter, and the base hit, and everything happened there in that first inning, it seemed like. But luckily, we ended up winning the game 6-2.
Well, the story is you were laughing through almost the whole thing.
I was laughing at it, and I didn't want to throw a ball too hard, afraid that one might get away from me and might go at him and might hit him. And then later on, Dizzy Trout was in the dugout, and he says if he had been pitching, he would have thrown at the little son of a gun.
Was this your first real dealing with Vec?
It was really the first deal with him, and I don't know. He did things for baseball that we should have more of today.
Well, today, looking back, it's been over 43 years now. What are your feelings about it today? Still pretty funny to you?
Well, yes, it is. Matter of fact, we hear more about it now than when it actually happened. Because every year around the latter part of July and August, the people seem to be bringing it up, and we hear a lot about it then.
Bob, something I'm curious about, we'll get to, you're going over to the Browns here in a minute. Today it seems like they have five or six or seven guys sitting on the bench. They have a hitting coach. They have a base running coach. They have this coach. They have that coach. When you were playing, what kind of instruction did you receive, either from the manager or from the coaches, or were you basically on your own as far as...
Actually, we were more or less on our own in a way, because all we had, it seemed like, if I can remember right, we had our manager, and we had our first and third base coach, naturally, and then we had a bullpen coach. Well, the bullpen coach would, I can always remember Ray Berry's up in Chicago there, who was a very good bullpen coach, and he knew a lot about pitching, and he would help us out a little bit. But outside of that, there wasn't the coaches that we have today.
What kind of, how about in spring training? Was there no great instruction there either, or was it just get in shape in your own?
Just get in shape, and we had a few little rules that we had to follow, and that was it.
Were any of the guys that you played for, any of the managers, real big on pregame meetings, going over the hitters and things like that?
Well, we would go over the hitters a little bit, but it seemed like that they more or less figured, well, you're in the major leagues, you know what you're supposed to do, so go out and do it. And that seemed like the biggest part of it then.
All right. Valentine's Day of 52, you're traded to the Browns, who are it'd be a battle between them, maybe in the A's at that point, if my memory serves me correct, is who might be the worst team in the American League?
It would be between the St. Louis Browns and the Chicago White Sox at that time.
Okay. So here you're going from Detroit, not a bad team, they didn't win the pennant, but now you're going back to the Browns, who were, and what'd you think of that deal?
Well, I was having contract trouble with Detroit. I think it was one thing that brought on the whole deal, because in Detroit, I tied Virgil Trucks with the most wins for Detroit pitching staff that year. And I had refused to sign the contract, and I was holding out a little bit.
What did they offer you?
If I remember right, at that time, I was only offered around $10,000 or something like that.
And it was the Briggs family that owned the team at this time?
Yes.
And you were looking for how much?
Well, I was wanting considerably more money than that, because after tying for the most wins on the ball club, well, I didn't feel that I should be one of the lower paid pitchers in the American League. Mm-hmm. And then when I got traded to St. Louis, Bill Vec says that... he called me and says, I understand you're having contract trouble. And I said, yes, Bill, I am. I says, I'm not going to sign for what they wanted me to sign for. And he asked me what I wanted. I told him. Bill says, well, come on down to St. Louis and sign. So my wife and I, we went down to St. Louis and signed a contract. And matter of fact, we signed the contract same day that Vic Wirth signed his contract there in St. Louis. And then we got on the train and went out to California for spring training.
Mm-hmm. Early in the 52 season, you hooked up with Feller again.
Yes, it seemed like every time I was pitching in the 50, 51, and 52, it seemed like that I was pitching either against the Yankees or Cleveland. And this was another case with Feller and I tying up, and we started the ball game, and Bobby Young was our first batter, and he hits a fly ball to left field, which, being a left-handed hitter, the ball was curving towards the foul line. Well, Jim Fridley was playing left field, and when the ball was hit, he started towards center field, whereas if he had stood still, I think he would have caught the ball. But it ended up over his head and went for a triple, and then Marty Marion hit a ground ball, and they let the run come in on that, and we got the run in the first inning, and Feller goes ahead and pitches a no-hit ball the rest of the ball game, and I was going along up until the fifth inning, and I give up my first base hit to Luke Easter, who had been to bat 19 times before without a base hit. And he happened to be one man that I always had trouble with, because even his first time at bat that time, he hit a long fly ball to right center field that our center fielder caught. But he got a solid base hit off of me in the fifth inning, and that ended up being the only hit that I gave up. And we ended up winning the ball game 1-0 on that one.
Mm-hmm. Tied the major league record for fewest hits in a game.
Yes.
What was it about Feller that when you two hooked up, it seemed to bring out the best in both of you?
I don't know, because I always thought that probably maybe Feller was one of the top pitchers of all time in the major leagues. And it always seemed that I always had a little luck every time I was pitching against him.
About a month and a half later, St. Louis changed managers. They got rid of Rogers Hornsby. What did you think of him as a he's a tough guy to play for, from what I read.
Actually, he wasn't as tough as I think what a lot of them have put down, because if you mind your own T's and Q's and didn't pay any attention to what actually a lot of the off-field things that Roger Hornsby did, why, you could get along with him and just go out and do the best you could. He criticized his players quite a bit, but still, I didn't seem to have too much trouble with him.
He was was he the one who played the ponies quite a bit?
He loved the horses, yes. And I guess I can say this, that especially when we'd go into Washington, he would allow Clint Courtney, our catcher, to take the day off to go out to bet the races for him, even.
Interesting.
And, I mean, we all got along pretty good with him, though.
Mm-hmm. He wouldn't allow in the clubhouse. It was all baseball. There was nothing else. There was
no fooling around. No.
No nothing.
Nothing like that at all.
So Vec gets rid of Hornsby, and is it true that the players then presented Vec with a trophy?
We presented Vec with a trophy in Boston, and immediately they made Marty Marion the manager then.
He was playing shortstop at the
he
time?
Was our playing shortstop, yes.
So then he continued on as player manager?
He played as a playing manager and finished out the year, yes.
And how'd you get along with him?
I got along with Marty all right. We didn't have too much trouble, no. Seemed like.
How you rolled your eyes there for a second. You have something that you want to talk about? Or?
Well, we had an incident happen here in Cleveland. It always happens here in Cleveland, it seems like. That, what was this, in 1953, he brings me in to relief pitch with Larry Doby at bat, and we had Dick Krajowski playing first base, and they had runner on base. And I get Larry Doby to hit a ground ball toward first, went right under Dick Krajowski's glove out into right field, and Marty comes out and takes me out of the ball game. and that kind of PO'd me at the particular time, and we had our words. And it seemed like from then on that I was more or less in his doghouse and didn't do much pitching for him the rest of the year.
I see. Guy that was on the 52 Browns, who was might have even been 52 at the time, Satchel Paige. You were 12-10 for the Browns that year, and he was 12-10 for the Browns that year. What do you remember about him?
Oh, we had so much fun with Satch. He was a real regular fella. We'd be out in the ball game, and Bill told him that he didn't have to be at the ballpark until the fifth inning or so, sixth inning. And Satch always loved his fishing. And there was a few games after the ball game at night where Satch would be fishing all day and he had no place to put his fish. So what would he do? He'd bring them out to the clubhouse, throw them in the shower, and then when we go in after the ball game to take a shower, there's the fish in the shower. And he was always pulling little shenanigans like that the other ball players, if they try to do something like that, would be reprimanded real bad.
It seems to me, well, Satchel certainly was a favorite of Vex.
He was a favorite of everybody, I believe.
Did he have a special seat or something in the bullpen? Was it a...
Bill Vec finally ended up getting him a contour chair out there, easy chair to let him really relax.
Mm-hmm. And he was,
because he could throw one or two pitches and he'd be ready to pitch in the ball game.
He was, what, at least, what, 45 at the time, probably older. What kind of stuff did he have at that age?
I would say he still had pinpoint control. He still had enough off-speed pitches to make him very effective.
He wasn't throwing 90-some mile an hour?
No, he wasn't throwing the real fast ball, but he could still throw the ball pretty good. And he had his change-up and his hesitation pitch, and he'd always keep the batters guessing.
1953, your last year with the Browns. Talk about the Browns fans for just a second. I read something that Ned Garver said. He said the Browns fans never booed the Browns because normally they were outnumbered.
Well, I'll tell you, I always made the saying that if it wasn't for our wives and the birds out there at the Sportsman's Park, we wouldn't have anybody in the stands at all. Because we were a very poor ball club. We have to admit that. And I don't blame the fans. They had the St. Louis Cardinals that they could go see. And the fans just were not coming out. Matter of fact, on the big episode with Eddie Goodell, the midget, we did have over 18,000 people, which is one of the largest crowds that Browns ever had there.
Tell me about Bobo Holloman.
I don't remember too much about Bobo. I always thought that he had only pitched the one game, the no-hitter, but I see that he had pitched other games with the St. Louis Browns, mm-hmm. too. He was strictly a character, and he did pitch the no-hitter, and then I guess the next day or so that they sent him out.
It wasn't too long after that he was gone, but that's kind of interesting. I'm just fascinated. Anybody named Bobo, I'm guessing, is going to be...
Bobo Newsom?
Yeah, he's got to be a character. Did you know Bobo Newsom well? Or?
I didn't know him well, no.
That 53 season, early in the year, maybe March of that year or something, Vec tried to move the team even then. He was thinking about moving the team to Baltimore. Do you remember that?
Yes, he wanted to move the team to Baltimore, and... there was the other owners that felt that he was making a joke out of baseball in the major leagues and just wouldn't allow him to move the team. But at the end of the year, they forced him more or less, I would say. They forced him to sell the ball club, and then they did move to Baltimore.
Any of that, any distraction to the team? Or?
No, because... all the players on the club knew that we had a bad team, and we knew that they were going to be moved, so there wasn't a thing that we could do.
At some point in the season, the Browns lost, they wound up 54-100 and lost 20 games in a row at home, which is kind of mind-boggling. I guess that's a major league record. But the very last game that the Browns played, lost to the White Sox 2-1. That was the 100th loss of the year. And I was reading somewhere that the team was in such financial straits that they basically ran out of baseballs the last game.
Yes, didn't even have enough baseballs to actually finish the game with good baseballs. But it was a case of Bill just running out of money and too much pressure put on him by the other owners of the league.
You mentioned something upstairs about coming back in and everybody finding $25 gift certificates after beating the Indians.
Yes, we had a game against the Indians, 1952, I think it was, that we beat the Indians, and it was such a big deal that the next day in our lockers, there was a miniature hat in there with a $25 gift certificate to a big department store in St. Louis that Bill Veeck had given to each and every ball player on the ball club. He was always doing little things. He had shirts with his picture on the label, and you go out and pitch a good game or get a base hit or help win a ball game, he'd give you a half dozen of the sports shirts. Or send you out to buy a new suit or something. He was always doing something for the players.
A generous guy. Quite a difference from Mr. Briggs. Huh?
He was a wonderful man to play for.
Tell me about the end of the 53 season. Were you with back then with the White Sox, or were you with the A's?
At the end of the 53 season, when they were moved, I was traded to the Philadelphia Athletics. And I went to spring training with Philadelphia down in West Palm Beach, Florida, and I ended up with calcium on my wrist, which I had earlier, I had pitched 5 shutout innings against the Brooklyn Dodgers. And in spring training, that was as far as most pitchers were going at that particular time. And then during the course of the night, my hand froze over and calcium formed in my wrist. And the next morning, I couldn't straighten my fingers up or move my wrist. And they classified it as calcium on the wrist. And then I stayed with the club until we got back up to Philadelphia, and even ended up renting a place in Philadelphia. And then on opening day, they sent me to Toronto.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a little bit more time on this side of the tape. Talk about 54 then. Through 56, the end of your pitching career?
Well, I was with so many different ball clubs in that period of time. I was with Toronto. I played there for a little bit, and then I went to, if I can keep these straight, from there we went to Birmingham. I was with Mobile. I was with Memphis. I was with Oakland.
Miami,
I was in there with Bill Veeck at Miami, yes.
Was Paige down there at that time, too? Or?
Satchel and I went together, yeah. Yes. And then I ended up down in Mobile, and that was in the middle of 56 season. And actually, I got kind of disappointed in baseball for the simple reason that after I got the calcium on the wrist in 54, in 55, or at the end of 54, I was in the Chicago White Sox organization, and they brought me back up at the end of the year and invited me to spring training in 55, and Marty Marion was the manager. Mm-hmm. And we go to spring training, and I turned around, and I had 13 1/3 scoreless innings pitching in spring training. He turns around and sends me out, and that kind of put a damper on me with the whole deal of baseball, because to me it made me feel like it wasn't a case of what you did, it was who you knew.
Mm-hmm.